Hello and welcome to the LRM podcast, sponsored by Adrian Flux Insurance. I'm Martin Dominey.
And I'm Steve Miller.
And you join us for an hour of chat about Land Rovers and everything to do with owning them. So there's news. Things are happening at the DVLA, Steve. Have you heard about this?
I have. And I think, from what I've seen, looks quite positive.
Well, hopefully, on the face of it, everything seems like, yes, it does seem positive. I'm not sure if, I mean, I've skimmed through it. For those not in the know, if you've not heard about this, the DVLA is having a bit of a shake-up on legislation when it comes to things like chassis modification, chassis replacement, restoration, Q-plates, which were a thing that you'd get allocated if your vehicle was rebuilt or needed an IP
latest. A lot of originality or identity.
The identity was gone.
Yeah, like a kit car.
Exactly.
Like
exactly. So the DVLA have recently released a whole bunch of new sort of guidelines and legislation on the ins and outs of... They've basically had a shake-up, haven't they?
I think they're saving themselves a load of backlog and staff because I think this is the sort of thing that keeps them really busy.
I would have thought so because...
There's got to be a reason.
You're looking at it on a vehicle-by-vehicle, case-by-case basis, even... just in the UK, which is, you know, a reasonably small country in the grand scheme of things, it must take them a serious amount of time to keep on top of all this, the intricacies of a rebuilt or restored or modified vehicle. So what they've done is they've come out with this on the 26th of August.
Which is, what, a couple of days ago?
Yeah, not that long ago at all, of, a new set of guidelines. So we're going to have a little flick through them and we're going to see how it affects people who have Land Rovers.
Okay.
Right, so kicking off, it says there's a new form that you can send off. So in the past, to give some background, in the past, if you replace a Land Rover's chassis with a brand new one.
Yes.
Galvanised, like-for-like replacement, you just do it.
Did it have to be galvanised?
No, it doesn't have to be galvanised, as long as you're not using a second-hand chassis from another vehicle.
Okay, yes.
You could just go ahead and do that and build the thing up and it would stay on its original plate.
Like you've done, like I'm doing.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
Now, when you do that, you can still do it and it's absolutely fine, but you have to tell the DVLA that it's had a replacement.
Okay.
As far as I can and garner from this.
Yeah, I've read similar.
The document kicks off by saying there's a legal requirement to notify the DVLA of any changes made to a vehicle which affects the information shown on the V5 registration certificate logbook, such as replacing the engine. Well, yes, that's always been the case to a degree, because if your logbook has an engine number on it, and a lot of them don't, a lot of older Land Rovers, the engine...
No, mine doesn't. My logbook hasn't.
No.
Certainly on my older 90.
But on newer stuff, if you're replacing the engine because it's failed, you would have to notify the DVLA of the new engine number, and then they'll send you a new logbook with the revised engine number on it.
Similarly, if you change the colour from green to blue, just tell them it's blue now, job done.
Quite simple.
Yeah, like changing your address.
So on the face of it there, not really any change. If you're changing your engine for a bigger engine, like my Series 3 was a 2.25 petrol standard, it's been swapped to a Rover V8 3.5 litre. It now shows 3,500cc on the logbook, but there's no engine number on it because there never has been.
I think there's a section on the logbook, isn't there, that goes from diesel to petrol?
Yeah, fuel type. You can change that.
Yeah.
There's more about this EV conversion, in fact.
Ugh.
And so basically they kick off with a bit of covering their own backsides by saying a vehicle keeper is responsible for making sure their vehicle is always safe to drive, roadworthy. A vehicle can be unsafe even if it has a current MOT, as the MOT only tests the vehicle's roadworthiness at the time of the test. We know that. There are penalties for driving a vehicle in a dangerous condition, obviously.
Yep, so nothing new there.
No, so that's all pretty much as we already know it to be.
But incidentally, though, so you could have changed your chassis and rebuilt your Land Rover, not as fast as I do things, obviously, because... that wouldn't have happened, but say if you were really super fast, re-chassis your Land Rover and it's still within the MOT, it's still valid, isn't it?
Yeah. Similarly.
I think that's crazy.
Do you?
So an amateur mechanic can sit in his shed at home, her shed, rebuild her Land Rover within the time of their Land Rover, still got a valid MOT,
and not have it...
And legally be allowed to just drive it down the road. But I suppose that's then on... The onus is on the owner, isn't it, to be driving a safe vehicle.
Exactly. So if they got pulled over and, like, and the brake pipes were all broken and suspension bushes were hanging out of it, you'd still get a get the book thrown at you, whether it's got a valid MOT or not, and rightly so.
Okay, but not great if that defect has caused a bad accident or something like that.
Oh, no, definitely not.
Yeah, but okay, things are changing, yeah.
So, part one, there's two parts to this document. Part one, repairs, restorations, and structural modifications.
Okay.
Vehicles which have been repaired or restored. So, unless the vehicle information shown on the V5 is affected, there's no requirement to notify the DVLA where the vehicle has been repaired or restored to return to its original working standard. Obviously, there's sub-settings to this repair or restore because in our scene with Land Rovers, you can go out to various different suppliers and buy everything you need, basically, to build a brand new Defender, which is kind of what you're doing, actually.
Which I had some backlash on recent YouTube, didn't I, about... Well, the identity of that car being an older car, should it be Q plate? Well, no, it's not.
No. And if there
should it have been,
if there was any question about that, then there certainly isn't now, because I think the DVLA are trying to save themselves some headache.
Okay.
Repairs and restorations will include the replacement of worn out components or body panels. We've all replaced body panels on our Land Rovers, I would have thought. On a like-for-like basis, and some of the same standards as the originals. The appearance of the structural parts of the vehicle must be the same as when it was originally manufactured, or to a period correct specification. Now, the only thing that makes me question this is obviously Defender and late series chassis were C-section that were welded together, so there was an overlap. There was a seam in the middle, wasn't there?
Yes.
Most galvanised chassis, not including Marsland, which is a GKN design, which was the old, basically a direct copy of the... In fact, they made Land Rover chassis.
Yeah, they were the original jigs, yeah.
Richards Mayer Shielder use flat plate instead of the twin C-section. Okay. So to look at, it's different.
But not to the detriment of its structure.
No, in fact, a lot of them are stronger. Okay, yeah, we're not going into that. There's a lot of stuff in here that's sort of interspersed with motorbikes, so we're not going to focus on that.
Oh, like changing frames.
Yeah, exactly.
This is the same as changing a chassis.
In fact, this is a great point they raise here. While repair and restoration work will not affect a vehicle's registration details, we recommend that you present your vehicle for an MOT as a roadworthiness check of the work that's been done. They recommend that. They're not telling you you have to, interestingly.
Yeah, I think it depends how competent you are as a mechanic, isn't it? Building a car up or restoring something.
Yeah, yeah,
whether
exactly.
You know.
If you're using good quality components and you're doing the work to a high standard, there is, in theory, no reason to do that. No reason to get it MOT'd again early. It's, again, this is the problem with this whole document. There's a lot of grey areas.
There's a lot of grey areas, and I think, having skim read some of this myself, I think... Some people will exploit it and possibly ruin it for the majority.
Possibly. It only takes one big accident
for all of this
stuff to come under scrutiny again. So, examples of repairs and restorations for cars and light good vehicles under 3,500 kilos, so Land Rovers, essentially, most of them. Repairs or restorations will include a boot floor, Disco One owners will be pleased to hear, and Range Rover Classic, footwells, front and rear arches, sills, suspension and steering, gearbox and axles, adding a roll bar or roll cage, removing an existing roll bar or roll cage, post-manufacture, so an aftermarket cage essentially, as long as attachment holes are welded over after it's removed.
But that doesn't really apply to Land Rover, does it? Because they sit on a plate on top of the chassis, don't they?
Generally, yeah.
So not, it's not like a...
They're not going to go to the extent
Mark II Escort rally car.
No, we're a
monocoque.
The only thing, that might potentially apply but is unlikely is if you've had like a Freelander that's been used in the Freelander Challenge and then you've taken the cage out to return it to the road. But again, that's pretty unlikely.
Yeah.
Replaced or corroded body panels, like-for-like panels, corroded areas of the chassis or monocoque body shell using a patch must be continuously seam welded. Well, that's standard MOT practice anyway.
Yeah.
Replacement of subframes, fitting seat belts and period correct accessories, for example, lamps and things.
You see, arguably you could weld a post a Land Rover that's over 40 years old, couldn't you? Not seam welded, because it doesn't have to go for an MOT.
You could, but you shouldn't.
No, I don't know. Do you know anyone that's spot welded something on? Yeah, you probably do. That face says everything. Have you done that?
No. But the difficulty is, even an MOT, really, the guide. I used to be an MOT tester. The guidelines of what you can and can't do after, before or after something gets repaired for an MOT, they're so strict on what you can actually do to prove that it's a good fix. For instance, say, for example, you have a rusty outrigger on a chassis, right? You cut the old one off, you get a new one, you fit the new one, you don't seam weld it, you spot weld it, or you weld it badly, or tack it.
Or you can't weld the top because you can't.
Exactly.
Body work,
anything
way.
Like that. You could put a load of seam sealer over that, put a load of underseal over that. As long as the tester can't see your welds, they can't fail it on that.
Okay.
Again,
mad, isn't it?
Another kind of grey area, because you can't.
You can't prove the strength of that weld.
If you send a car for MOT with a recently repaired area, but the underseal or the paint is still wet or can be damaged, they can't touch it. To you could use silicon sealant and underseal over it, and the tester can't, if the surface is still wet, they can't actually, you know, even use thumb pressure.
Wow.
It's really bad.
That is bad.
Which is, you know, why you see horrific MOT repairs sometimes, because it's so controlling.
Mm, yeah.
Right, so here we're getting into the meat of it now. Repairs and restorations that affect the vehicle identification number. So, if the repair or restoration affects the site of the VIN, vehicle identification number, the VIN plate will need to be re-stamped or attached to the replacement chassis, monocoque body, shell or frame, by a garage that provides this service. We recommend you keep evidence of the work completed showing the VIN, so take pictures before you re-chassis, and keep, doesn't say it in as many words, but essentially, as we've always said in Land Rover Monthly magazine, if you are fitting a galvanised chassis, make sure you keep the offside front spring hanger or outrigger on a defender.
Which I have done. I've got, the entire front dumbarton section.
Yeah,
leg.
With your original chassis number in it, which is a sensible precaution to take, because if the history of the vehicle ever gets chased,
you
can say, this is my old chassis.
So I haven't got my VIN stamped into my
new chassis. Yeah.
But by rights, at what point should I have done that? Because this doesn't tell me.
I know.
Re-chassied my Land Rover technically
4 years ago.
4 years ago.
Yeah.
But it has never been on the road since.
There's going to be overlap.
At what point was the chassis fitted? Since an MOT or what? I mean, I fully intend getting the VIN stamped into the chassis. Do I then destroy the original chassis leg?
I'd keep it anyway, personally.
Yeah,
but it is tricky. And again, we recommend that you keep evidence of the work completed before and after showing the VIN. It's not saying you absolutely have to. We recommend.
I think you should anyway, because...
Yeah, I do.
Well, it's part of a record of what you've achieved when you've restored a car or your Land Rover.
Yes. So...
Okay, that's okay then. So they just need informing that you've re-chassised your Land Rover.
Where a chassis, monocoque body shell or frame for a motorcycle has been replaced like for like. Right, okay, this is it. This is where it changes now. For example, without changing the vehicle's appearance or dimensions from its original manufacturer specification. So say you've got a rusty defender, you want to change the chassis on it. This applies now. This is classed as a repair, but it does not need to be notified to DVLA using the new form. That's replace like for like. See, this is where it becomes complicated, because is like for like, technically, does that stretch to a single plate chassis, a box frame chassis, or does that only include things like the Marsland C section, which is visually exactly the same as the original? where do you draw the line? Things like the Mayer chassis have got revisions on them, like bigger holes so you can flush mud out of them, and they've done away with the two layers of steel and fitted thicker single sheets and things like that.
I suppose DVLA have written this as, obviously, of course they have, but as a more general. But with Land Rover, we know there's so many specifics.
Mm.
For example, you can go to Richard Chassis and have the mounts welded on a new chassis for a 300 TDI instead of a natural spread, like I've had done. So all of a sudden, your chassis technically has changed.
The replacement can either be brand new or second-hand, but must be of the same specification as the original, although a non-galvanised chassis or frame can be replaced with a galvanised one. But it doesn't mention anything to do with construction.
And because it doesn't, I think you're fine.
Well, honestly, yeah, these
you heard it here first.
They can be, these can be, you know, construed it's however you want.
Interpretation, yeah.
We recommend the vehicles presented for voluntary MOT as a roadworthiness check.
So if it's over 40 years old,
again,
they recommend, but you don't have to.
If you're using second-hand replacement, we never, never ever recommend using a used, like a second-hand chassis. But if you do, evidence of the identity of the donor vehicle must be provided, including the V5. So you need a complete paper trail for whatever vehicle you use the chassis from.
So is that saying then that if you did that, the car retains its original identity from an identity of another one? So what do they do? Scrap the one that you've...
I think you would keep all of the paperwork that you can, and then you would, yeah, you'd
two vehicles become one.
Basically, yeah. You'd, what's the word? Certificate of destruction. Logbook for donor vehicle, receipts from identifiable suppliers. So you need as much paperwork, the paper trail as you can. But again, realistically, 99% of people are using new galvanised chassis for Land Rover rebuilds.
Anyway, I wouldn't go to this and put a second-hand chassis on a Land Rover.
No. Oh, there you go. In fact, where second-hand parts are used... must only be taken from a vehicle sourced carefully with only minor components being able to be taken from a vehicle which has been issued with a certificate of destruction.
So if your Land Rover is a hardtop van and you converted it to softtop,
yep.
Does it still look the same appearance?
It's all open to interpretation, isn't it, Steve?
Yeah. Or a truck cab for a hardtop.
Yeah, and I mean, whatever vehicle gave up its hardtop and sides, that's not going to have been scrapped. That's going to have been turned into something else anyway, hasn't it?
Yeah. Part, you know, the classifieds are awash with second-hand hardtops, softtops, truck cabs, all manner of things.
So, once your application's processed, we will provide authorisation for the part to be re-stamped with the VIN or frame number. This must be re-stamped next to or in the same area as the existing stamping. Any existing identification number must be partly obliterated, so that's if you're using a used thing. Interesting. So, to simplify... if it's like for like, it's not a modification, it's a repair. But it does need to be notified to the DVLA using V627-1. There you go.
Okay.
Moving on. Structural modifications. So if you're doing a bobtail or you're cutting the roof off a Range Rover to make a pickup or something ridiculous like that.
Like the olden days.
Like, yeah, doing a bobtail classic to go trialling. Vehicles that have been structurally modified from their original specification. You must notify the DVLA when a vehicle has undergone a structural modification. It must be done using the form that I quoted earlier. Modified vehicle statement, a V627-3, which you can get off the gov.uk website, and an MOT may be required. So... this work should only be carried out by a person with the relevant engineering knowledge to carry out a modification safely.
Knowledge or qualification?
I know.
Yes,
again.
So read LRM, you might have the knowledge to say that you've done it safely.
What is a structural modification? Cutting into a vehicle's chassis, in the case of a vehicle with a separate chassis, i.e. a Land Rover.
Yeah.
Monocoque body shell or frame motorbike, not fussed about that. It's important to note that cutting into the above components for repair without changing the original specification is classed as a repair or restoration, not a modification. So changing, like, an outrigger is a repair. Question is, when you get into things like rear cross members, if you can't get an early type cross member, is a later type TDI or TD5 cross member a modification or a repair? I feel like we're asking more questions than we're answering.
Yeah, and, well, this is... yeah, but the bods at DVLA probably aren't qualified to tell you that's the wrong crossmember for that Land Rover.
No.
Like a military crossmember.
Yeah.
Versus a civilian.
Yeah, you could cut a military one off and put a civilian one.
Which quite often people do.
Yeah.
Or have done. But this is obviously going forward. This isn't retrospective. So if you're driving around in a car that's...
they haven't said it is. So they haven't said it's retrospective.
You can't all just flood the market with, or flood DVLA with questions.
A structural modification will include, but is not limited to the following. Lengthening, shortening, widening a vehicle's chassis or body shell to accommodate a different shape or style of body shell to resemble a different type of vehicle. So...
a 90 to a 110.
Yeah, or doing something off the wall, like putting a BMW body on a 110 chassis, or it literally says here, changing the appearance of a car or van to resemble a pickup. So is...
ooh, okay.
But that's not... they're not talking nuts and bolts, though. They're talking cutting into the shell. So...
Like...
that's okay. That's like, doing a trayback discovery. If you wanted to use that on the road, that would be technically... cutting one or more roof pillars, removing the roof, removing a roll cage, modifying the design of subframe or support members.
But cutting the roof of a Discovery doesn't affect its structural integrity because it's
not
a chassis.
Because it's not monocoque. Yes, true.
So,
but it doesn't actually specify that here.
And how did DVLA know when you did it?
Yeah, that's another great point.
Like, you know, decided this 10 years ago, mate. You know, they're not going to know.
No.
Are they? But your insurance company should know.
Oh, they absolutely should. Yeah, they absolutely
interestingly
should.
Interestingly, right, this is probably a great time to hear from our sponsors.
Yes, indeed.
We're proud to partner with Adrian Flux, an insurance broker that specialises in covering all types of Land Rovers, including classic, ex-military, modified and Q-plated models. Adrian Flux offers a range of optional extras to make the policy your own and can provide cover for off-roading, green laning, agreed value and build-up cover. Plus, they even offer a discount of up to 15% for Owners Club members. Simply search Adrian Flux Land Rover Insurance for more information or call them directly on 0344 728 0417 for a quote.
Anyway, so you've just heard from Adrian Flux. Now, if you have got a modified vehicle,
yes,
they do specialise in that. So
they do.
If you've got any questions on the insurance, be sure to give them a shout.
Definitely, yeah. They've always been very helpful when I had my Land Rovers with them. And they understand modifications. They understand upgrades, engine changes, things like that. So give them a shout. They're very, very good people. So we're going to try and speed through this because it's a lot to read.
It's a massive document, but it's on gov.uk.
Have a skim through and see what you think.
And this probably only applies to listeners that are in the UK.
Yes, it would do.
You'll have your own rules outside of the UK.
Yeah, so let's go to... So this is quite interesting here. MOT requirements for modifications. Vehicles over 40 years old. So if your Land Rover is over 40 years old, it'll be MOT exempt as well as tax exempt. To submit a modification for vehicles over 40 years old, you'll need to provide an MOT. So if you're taking advantage of the MOT exemption and you want to do a modification like, well, whatever we've described already, changing the engine or whatever, you'll need an MOT.
Okay.
Can you see where this might be a problem? Because people might do an engine change and then they'll go, oh, I don't really want to get it MOT'd. So they won't get it MOT'd and then they won't send it off as a modification. And then the DVLA, if for whatever reason they get pulled over and the car is inspected, they'll go, oh, I did that in 2004.
Yeah. There's a lot of loopholes. Not loopholes, there's a lot of holes in this, I think.
Yes, they're putting quite a lot of trust in people.
Which is it? Just because they're trying to offload a load of work and a load of admin, I can imagine that's the case.
Possibly. Q-Reg.
Yes.
Q-Reg has always been a bone of contention. Now...
would you buy a Q-Reg car?
I would be nervous about it. Just
personally,
because
wouldn't.
The resale stuff of... resale values of Q-plates are always a fair bit lower than like their contemporary historic Reg counterparts.
And insurance premiums are higher on a Q plate as well.
They can be, they're not always.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Speed Trading Flux. they will soon tell you.
Yes. So it's good news on the Q plate front.
Okay.
Where there's a question over the identity of a vehicle, the DVLA may require the vehicle to be inspected. That's nothing new. If it can't be determined, if the age or identity of a vehicle can't be determined, it may require re-registration. Okay, so if the vehicle doesn't have an identification already, it will probably still go on a Q plate from what I can get, from what I can garner in this. If it does, if it's had an identity and for whatever reason it's not registered, it's far more likely to go back on a historic plate than a Q plate, as was the case a few years ago.
Okay.
So the inability to determine whether the identity of a vehicle could occur when it's presented for registration without its original documents, it doesn't have a VIN or chassis number, the VIN or chassis number has been lost, is not presented for a requested inspection. So essentially, if the vehicle is a complete unknown, it will probably still go on a Q plate. If it does have its reg, but it isn't registered, you're in luck.
Okay.
So this goes into, you can fix up a sort of unregistered vehicle with any number of the restoration techniques. And then once that's done, you submit your registration or your restoration or modification statement. And then, providing there are no concerns over a vehicle's identity, a structurally modified vehicle will keep its original VIN and registration number. It will fall into one of three categories: rebuilt, assembled from parts, some or all of which were not new; modified, original chassis frame has been modified from the original manufacturer's specification; electric conversion, pretty interesting; the original combustion engine's been replaced by an electric motor and battery. And they'll basically put a marker on the front of the logbook. So it will keep its identity, but in the special notes section, it will say rebuilt, modified, or electric.
So you could have, legitimately, a 40-plus-year-old classic Land Rover with an electric modern motor.
You can do that now. Yeah, it will just say something different on the logbook. Yeah,
perfect.
So this goes into kit builds and things like that. Reconstructed vehicles is probably the most relevant here. The reconstructed classic category is intended to support the restoration of unregistered classic vehicles. So this is what I touched on a second ago.
Yeah.
If you've bought an old Land Rover out of a shed and it's currently got no V5, but the thing is complete and it needs restoring.
So it's not been registered as a historic vehicle in its time yet.
Yeah, it's just a complete vehicle. It might have a VIN. It doesn't have a logbook, whatever. Yeah. Reconstructed vehicles must be composed of genuine period components that are over 25 years old and the same specification. So ideal for people who like to go to the LRM auto jumbles, because there's tons of parts available for restoring Land Rovers. The appropriate vehicle enthusiasts club for the mark must confirm in writing that the following inspection, they authenticate the vehicle as a true reflection of that mark and meets the above criteria, which the majority of restored classic Land Rovers would.
Yeah.
Especially if, you know, they're going back to standard, like, again, which is pretty current.
So the appropriate vehicle enthusiast club.
Yeah.
Define that club.
So in my mind, and I don't know if you have to go through any kind of qualifications to be...
Exactly.
Series 1 club.
We could be a club right now.
Series 2 club.
Yeah.
Range Rover register. I don't know.
But you could just be a Facebook group club.
Yeah, I mean, they haven't gone into that.
And somebody without qualification could say...
It's fine.
It's fine.
Yeah.
Not sure about this. It's positive and negative.
I think it's erring on the side of positive, but it really could be misconstrued in a lot of ways. So basically, you send off your application and if everything comes back fine, an age-related registration number will be issued based on the age of the youngest component used. So how you determine the age of the component?
So if you went to one of our auto...
Reconstructed classics or replica classic built... Yeah, we're not too fussed about that.
I would be really interested to hear from some of our listeners and their thoughts on this.
Definitely.
editorial@lrm.co.uk. Tell us what you think. Tell us where you fit with this. What your thoughts are, because I don't know.
Yeah, so finally, I won't dwell on this much longer because it's much easier to read yourself and get a judgment of what you think. But So essentially, reconstructed, whatever. An explanation will be included in the special notes section of the V5. Rebuilt, assembled from some parts, some or all of which were not new. I guess that's probably going to apply to most people with old Land Rovers rebuilding them. So your V5 will stay exactly the same if the vehicle has kept its identity and it is what it is. It just says in the special notes, it'll say rebuilt, which is probably what yours will end up with.
That's what all the time you've been telling me, well, reading this out, I've been thinking, where do I fit with this?
There you go. It'll probably say rebuilt.
Yeah, because it is. But it's still the same old Land Rover.
Yeah.
That triggers broom saying that you hear all the time.
I wanted to give some clarity to people about the new DVLA legislation, but I feel like I've probably just confused them more, so sorry about that.
Yeah, I feel more confused. I think I need to go away after this and read it myself, as did other people listening to this.
Yeah, have a little...
We've added the questions in that people are probably thinking.
Yeah.
How do I fit?
And also, it's kind of a barrage of information when someone's reading it out to you. It's much easier to get a cup of tea and have a little flick through it yourself and see what you reckon to it.
Anyway, let's move on to something properly like positive, shall we?
Let's move on to something that isn't
legislation.
DVLA and boring legislation. Stuff. Shall we do? I'm fully aware that I've been slacking on this the last few podcasts. Should we do Feature of the Week?
I forgot that existed.
Yeah, I know. I've sort of let it go by the
wayside. Well, last week we were in my lovely garage.
We were in your garage, yeah. I didn't have a copy of the mag to hand. But today, Feature of the Week. This I absolutely love. So, lovely couple. Sergio and Eleni Medeiros have been living in their Defender for 10 years. They haven't had a house for 10 years. They've been driving around.
Actually living in the Defender.
Living in the Defender. They've been all over the place.
Where do they keep their washing machine?
Well, they don't have a washing machine on board, Steve. Where would you put a washing machine?
I don't know.
It just goes to show if you
commitment.
And do you know what? I mean, I looked at this and their Defender, they've obviously revised it over the years with bits they've needed, but also got rid of stuff they don't need. It's actually kind of a basic setup and they've lived out of it for 10 years. So, yeah, it just goes to show they've been some absolutely amazing places as well. Yeah, so check that out in the latest issue of Land Rover Monthly, which is on sale now. You can read all about what they do. They're doing really great work as they go around the place. They've been, yeah, it's a true nomadic lifestyle out of a really, really cool Defender as well. It, even, you know, as I say, it's not bristling with the latest and greatest tech. It's just they've gone about it in a very methodical, logical way, and it's just what they need. And, yeah. Really nice people. So yeah, give that a look.
Sounds interesting.
Shall we roll beautifully and slickly into Product of the Week?
Hit me with it. What have we got?
So you've actually got one of these, I believe. It is a double DIN dash mount for your Defender TD5.
Yeah, I have one, but I haven't fitted it yet.
This is the second generation, so you're already a generation out. Sorry about that.
Yeah. I just guess for dress sense.
Yeah, that's a few generations out, I think. So this, the latest version of their very popular double DIN console also allows fitment of additional switches down the side, and you can use either Mud UK's dash switches or OEM Land Rover ones. So you've got a bank across the top where your hazard light switch is, and then you've got a couple down the sides for your electric windows, heated seats, things like that.
Yeah.
And below that, you've got provisions to fit 12-volt sockets. So it's actually a great way of keeping your dashboard clutter-free because it's all just right there in the middle.
Really handy, actually.
You haven't got extra switches hanging out all over the place and, you know, cutting holes in your dashboard. So, yeah, that's a really nice bit of kit. Mudstuff.co.uk. Prices start from £180. Check it out.
Nice.
You've got dashboard things to talk about, haven't you? You're on the hunt.
Still on the hunt for a Defender lower dash.
There
is, like, difficult to find.
They're an elusive
beast. We found one, didn't we? We went to the York Land Rover show. And I was kind of...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But it just wasn't good enough. You know, it just wasn't... And how much was that? No, it's £40, isn't it?
No. I can't remember how much the one at York was.
40 or 60. £40. It was £40.
Was it?
Yeah.
The difficulty is...
Like hen's teeth to find, apparently. Where's all this stuff gone? It used to be like in skips.
I know.
People used to chuck things away, and all of a sudden the value's gone through the roof.
Well, they're one extreme to the other, the Defender Dashes. I think because people know they're being restored, they ask a lot for a clean one. But you've either got like the real rough end, which has had a big hole cut in it for an extra, like a Raptor console.
Yeah, yeah, which I may or may not have in my possession.
Or it's had, you know, the tar kicked out of it off-road all the way up to like really, really clean. Vinyl's perfect. The metal's not rusty. And they're asking, you know, hundreds and hundreds of pounds.
Where did we find... And that was that one, wasn't it? York. The vinyl was really good, but the metal had...
It was a bit flaky, yeah.
I can't find it. It's one or the other.
Or you could buy a brand new one from...
860-odd pounds for a brand new lower dash. It's ludicrous amounts of money, I think. Well, it is.
It is. It's a lot of money, isn't it, for a dashboard piece. But
There's SP4x4, we manufacture them, but they're over £600. So they must be quite expensive to produce.
Yeah, I'd have thought so. And they're probably reading the market as well and seeing what the good used ones are going for and going, well, yeah, yeah. If we're clever, we'll go a little bit above that and see what we can do.
Yeah. Not good.
George Benbow has been in touch. We have an email. He says, "Hi, guys. I love listening to the podcast while I'm driving and love using it to learn new things about Land Rovers. I'm 24 and I've had two Land Rovers, my first being a Discovery 2, which turned out to be extremely rotten all over the chassis." I don't believe a word of that.
Yeah.
"But I still got a year of use out of it before having to sell. After that, I bought a Disco 3, as I've always wanted one, and I've turned it into a camping rig with a roof tent and a drawer set up in the back." Very cool. "Me and the family have had lots of successful trips away, including a 16-day trip around Norway, which I've documented on my TikTok and YouTube, which is at Overland Rover TD5. So at Overland Rover TD5. I love sharing all the adventures we have and showing all the fun you can have in a Land Rover."
Well, I'm definitely going to check him out because Norway is on my list of places to go. It looks amazing.
I've always thought Scandinavia would be an awesome... I really like the landscapes and the countrysides and those massive tall trees.
I'm all over that, so I will be checking him out.
Good cold air and, yeah, good driving, gravel roads. Keen. He goes on to say, "A really cheeky ask, and we're not making a habit of doing this, so please don't bombard me with emails about it. I'm currently planning a Land Rover camping meetup on September the 19th to the 21st in the Peak District. Could you please give me a little shout out on the podcast? As you were the first to ask, I'm going to say yes, but this is it now. We're drawing a line. All the details are on my social pages at Overland Rover TD5, I'd imagine. It's free to come along. Anyone who has a Land Rover who likes to camp in or on it, I'm trying to get as many Land Rovers together as possible, and I've found a lovely farm to host it on. Keep up the great work with the podcast. I love hearing all the stories, and hopefully I'll hear myself in an episode soon." Well, George, consider it done.
Keep listening.
Keep on trucking. Nice to hear from a good young Land Rover enthusiast who's making stuff happen.
Definitely. Peak District is a great place as well.
Definitely, yeah. Yeah, I really like the Peak District. I need to get up there more, really. Alistair's always keen for a Peak District, isn't he?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
We've been a bit busy this year to squeeze it in, but definitely get it in a diary for next year, if not before, and go and have a little drive around in the hills. Very pleasant indeed. Right, we have another email from Tommy Caradice. He says, "Hi, guys. Keep up the good work. I've been listening to the podcast from the start." Thanks, Tommy.
Which is well over a year now.
I know. "It keeps me company travelling up and down the country as a diesel field service engineer. I was catching up on the podcast and I heard Martin's issue regarding what vehicle to put the roof tent on. Me and my friend Jason attended York Land Rover show in our Series 3s. Jason has the same tent as you and I've got a tent box light. I'm running a 2.25 diesel from an early 90 and Jason 200 TDI with no turbo." So a 200 DI, as they call it in the game. "We managed to cruise from Lancashire to York via the Yorkshire Dales and even hit 60 on the bypass. Maybe it won't be as bad on the 110 as you think. Hope this helps. Cheers." And he's included a picture of his rather lovely series, complete with roof tent. Look at that.
Oh, yeah, very nice. Yeah.
I think you might be right, Tommy. I think you might be right. I think the problem with the 110 is it doesn't actually get up to speed that slowly, as you found out, because it's geared so low.
Very low geared.
So as long as you're okay doing 55, it probably wouldn't make that much of a difference to have the roof tent on. So we'll see.
You could give it a go.
Do you know what was weird about the fitting it on the Freelander was I expected there to be a noticeable drop in like acceleration, but there isn't. But you do feel the weight being high up.
I suppose a drag only really starts at over a certain speed, doesn't it?
Yes. It also hasn't actually affected the fuel consumption as much as I thought it might.
Right.
It's dropped a couple, but I think actually putting the rack on affected it more than putting the tent on the rack. I think because the rack's already there, it doesn't really make that much of a difference.
Right. Yeah, yours isn't that high a tent, is it?
No.
Like, it's quite streamlined.
Reasonably, yeah.
Reasonable. It looks quite significant on a Freelander 2.
Well, they're a smallish car, aren't they?
Yeah.
I'm going to give the old tent a good try tomorrow. I'm going camping tomorrow night.
Tomorrow night? Yeah. You will no longer be a rooftop tent virgin.
Indeed. I'm going to get up all in that roof tent and see what it's all about. Yeah, I'm excited for that. It's going to be good fun. So I was thinking on the way here, I can't stop thinking about the P38s. And I thought...
Oh, guys, moves on from L322s.
Well, I don't know if I have. But my question is, because the P38, I think, has really sort of come of age now, and I really like the look of it. You get the right spec. Do you know what I mean? Like the 18-inch Hurricanes, maybe light guards, and a good colour.
Well, you know the one we saw at Billing?
Which one was
the black one?
Yes. Oh, yeah, last year.
I saw him, actually.
I didn't catch him
from
this
Ireland.
Year. Yeah, I didn't catch him this year.
Yeah, I saw him walking around. But that vehicle, that's the best P30 I've ever seen.
Yes. I think it might be the best all-round P30 I've ever seen, definitely. But what is your favourite model from each generation of Land Rover?
As in?
So, Freelander, Discovery, Range Rover, Series, Defender. Let's split Series and Defender up because we can.
Yeah.
Why not?
Because why not?
I'm putting you on the spot here, aren't I?
Yeah. So
let's start with Discovery. Discovery 1 to 5. What is your favourite?
To look at Discovery 2.
Let's go purely on looks because we could really get lost in this, but let's go purely on looks. Discovery 2.
I still think the Discovery 2 looks current.
Really?
Yeah.
Pre or post facelift?
Now you're getting splitting hairs. The facelift, Discovery 2,
okay,
is the ultimate of Discovery.
Okay.
In my opinion.
I don't disagree with
yeah.
you. I'm taught.
Although, to drive, Discovery 4 is the best.
We're just going on looks for this. For the looks. Because otherwise, because okay. yeah. That's what sort of brought it all about for me, was the some of them are coming of age, and I think, yeah. Discovery 2 facelift. I think, again, if like a top specker, like a Metropolis with the fat roof bars and the like 18-inch Comet wheels and...
G4.
Oh, yeah. A black or silver G4 edition. Oof.
Didn't they do a yellow one?
They did do Borrego yellow and Tangiers orange, but you don't see many of them.
Mm.
That's a shame, really, because the shouty colours, the orange and the yellow, I think were maybe a little bit too in your face for a lot of UK buyers. I don't know the figures of... how that limited edition was sold, but you see more black ones, certainly, than you do the other colours.
A Money No Object has a 4-litre V8 one.
Would you? They are.
After that, yeah. But, you know, running one of them every day would be a bit of a commitment.
It would be a commitment, but, yeah, it's a great combination, a 4-litre and that decent 4-speed electronically controlled auto. They just waft.
Go on, fire at the next one.
Range Rover. So, Range Rover Classic, P38, L322, L405, L460.
Okay. CSK Classic.
Yeah, I'm with you on that, actually.
Are we agreeing on two?
I don't think Classic is my favourite anymore. I don't know.
Really?
I'm erring on the... I don't know. A 3-door Classic.
Yeah, CSK.
I think that's fair. Let's switch to Series. So... to be specific, this can be Series 1, 2, 3, or it can be forward controls, but not Defender.
Okay. For me...
you're talking just looks, don't forget.
Series 2A, but the late one with the lights on the outside.
In the wings. With lights the in the wings. Grill. Interesting. With the Maltese cross mesh grill.
Short wheelbase.
Yeah.
Truck cab? Weirdly.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I'm torn between...
beautiful little thing.
Either headlight...
2.25 petrol as well.
All right, let's not get too specific. I'm torn between either...
this is like how Dreamland of this.
Series 2 or 2A with headlights in the grille panel, because I think they're a little bit more chocolate box classic.
They are, yeah.
Probably with a hard top. marine blue with a hard top.
I said 2 1/4 petrol. Now you're naming the colour.
Yeah, because the colour is a visual thing. You can't tell if it's got 2 1/4 petrol.
What's that pastel green colour?
Is it not just called pastel green?
Well, that pastel green, yeah, that's colour of mine.
All right, fine, okay.
If you're going for marine blue.
All right. Yes, I think that. I would differentiate because I would go for headlights in the grille panel rather than in the wings, but...
Yeah.
All right, so coil sprung then. 110, 1983, 110, all the way into Defender, all the way to the end of Defender in 2016. What are you picking? Based purely on looks.
Oh, my goodness.
You've got to go wheelbase, body style, and we'll put colour in as well. Why not?
Well, that's easy for me.
Go on.
AA yellow, NAS 90.
Yeah.
4-litre V8.
I hadn't even considered that.
Yeah, see, I did. I know what my Dreamlander lineup is. That's it.
Yeah. No, it's hard to... I think I would go... I know they're quite useless, but I really like 110 double cabs. 110 double cab, Montalcino red.
Montalcino red is a beautiful colour.
I wouldn't have the Puma because I don't like the Puma bonnet. I'd have TD5 or 300. It doesn't really matter. They'd look the same. That's what I'd go for.
Okay. They are really useless, double cabs.
They take the useless features of a proper-sized double cab, like a Japanese double cab, and then they make them even more useless by getting rid of even more legroom in the back and even more tub space. Like, a 90 pickup's fairly useless. A 110 double cab pickup, you can get, like, a box of tissues in the back, and that's about it.
Very useless.
Anyway.
Yeah. I've named the most useless Land Rover.
Freelander. The last family. Freelander 1, pre-post-facelift. Freelander 2, pre-post-facelift. I'll go first.
Yeah, you go first.
The last of the Freelander 2s. 14 plate with like the real modern front end and the like the LED style rear lights. I really like them.
Yeah, I mean, I can't agree with you on most things here. This is ridiculous.
I was expecting you to say something like a Monte Carlo blue 3-door pre-facelift with like a softback or something.
No.
They seem quite in vogue at the moment.
Yeah, no.
Nick Dimbleby's shipping his off to faraway climbs. I think they're doing a Himalayas drive with them.
Okay.
I'd like to get that in the mag. Nick, if you're listening, hit me up.
Yeah, it has to be a late Freelander 2 for me. They
nailed it, didn't they, with the design?
They really did, actually. Very, very practical, reliable. That's why they're holding their price.
From a looks point of view, they didn't really change the actual main body of it at all. They just, I guess, facelifts can often look like not an afterthought, but like they didn't really take much consideration of the actual original body style. They just put newer lights on and then called it a facelift.
Yeah.
The Freelander 2 looked...
bumpers and stuff.
Yeah, I think it looked more complete as a vehicle, as a facelift, than a pre-facelift.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. What do you think? What's your favourite Land Rover from each Land Rover family? We want to know about it and we'll talk about it on the podcast. Editorial at lrm.co.uk.
And why? Why is it?
Why? And if it might be the Land Rover you own, I wouldn't blame you. But
notice we don't own any of our absolute... We've not named our own cars.
No, we haven't, have we?
So we've not said we own the one that we would...
Right.
I'm kind of building it. I'm building a NAS spec.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. So what about the Sir Winston Churchill special edition that's just been launched?
Yes.
Or released?
Yes.
Seeing how much they are?
Quite expensive, aren't they?
Yeah.
200 odd thousand quid.
135,000? Could you imagine like 10 years ago saying that there was going to be a Defender at that kind of level? Or even 20 years ago. Can you imagine?
It's a lovely looking thing. It's very reminiscent of the limited edition that never came to be that's in the British Motor Museum.
I kind of feel like I've seen it before.
Yeah, it's bronze green with bronze green wheels. And it's like, oh, hang on a minute. That looks kind of like heavily inspired from that.
And how many are they building?
I haven't
10 or 100, I can't remember.
No, it's not 100, it's a lot less than that. I haven't got the release here. In fact, let me look it up quickly because I feel like I'll be...
You should know.
Yeah, I should know off the top of my head.
At the forefront of editorial, Land Rover editorial perfection, you should know.
Well, to be fair,
there's not been very many. And
you brought it up, so you could have done the research yourself.
But I, you know, because, you know, these podcasts aren't planned.
Well,
that was planned. The DVLA stuff was planned.
Yeah, the DVLA stuff was. So it's using the tried and tested formula of the 5-litre naturally aspirated V8 with the 8-speed auto gearbox.
Nice.
Oh,
so they are at £235,000.
Well, yes, based on donors between 2012 and 2016, so the very end of production, really.
I hope they inform DVLA of their modification.
You know your 4x4. You've chosen every upgrade, every bolt-on with purpose. So when it comes to tyres, chunkier, wider, more capable for the conditions, you want the perfect fit. Not just any tyre, your tyre. That's why you'll choose 4x4tyres.co.uk, the wheel and tyre specialists, trusted by Land Rover owners and serious off-roaders alike. Whether you're upsizing, overlanding, making your Defender look the part, or your Discovery turn heads, we'll guide you to the right set. With over 800 fitting locations across the UK, from online to on-road, we've got you covered. Browse by vehicle, wheel size or brand. 4x4tyres.co.uk. The right fit, the right place, the right price.
Yeah, so obviously Winston Churchill's well known for that famous photo with the Series 1 with the Reg UKE 80. Really cool thing, which was gifted to him for his 80th birthday back in 1954. Bet you didn't know that.
I didn't realise he was going to be 80 when he was gifted that.
No, indeed not. But yeah, it's a really, really cool thing. Only 10 being built.
There's your answer. 10.
Yeah, it was 10. So yeah, super, super exclusive. And because they start at £279,000 for the 90, and if you want a 110, then you can add an extra $5,500 on top of that.
279.
279 for the 90.
So I've read 235 somewhere.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
295, 200 for the 110 with the VAT. Maybe you read it ex-VAT.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
Probably did then, yeah.
It is not a cheap thing. However, it is rather lovely. So if you're in the fortunate enough position to be able to buy one of these absolute beauties, then yeah, good luck to you.
I don't think it matters if you're in the fortunate position to buy one. I think you'll have been invited by now.
Probably, yeah. It would sit next to you. Isla edition and your 70th edition and your trophy one and your trophy two.
Yeah, alongside all manner of other great stuff.
Lovely machinery.
I just think it's almost an unusable thing. You're not going to use it, are you, at that level?
I think if you were to buy one and use it regularly, like daily drive it as your main car, that would be a bigger flex than buying one and then shoving it in a heated garage. Same with anything exotic, really.
Yeah,
I think
definitely.
It's far more interesting.
Yeah, exclusive, yeah.
To see them out about.
You get an invite to drive it, do you?
To drive? Well, I did drive the bespoke stuff, which it will be the same to drive because it's still 5-litre V8.
Which what I should imagine is glorious.
It really is very well put together. I give my opinion of it on our YouTube video where I go to Land Rover Classic and have a play. Really, really cool. Yeah, really well integrated as well. Like a lot of converted Defenders don't quite feel right, but they've nailed it with that. So, yeah, I mean, not a cheap thing, but if you're in that the upper echelons of Land Rover ownership, grab yourself one. Only 10. I can't imagine they're going to depreciate much.
No, I shouldn't imagine so.
Indeed, indeed, indeed. What's on your list of jobs for this week then? Have you got much that you can do with the 90? You've got a bit of tub alignment, haven't we?
Well, I've got some bits ready to go to paint.
Excellent.
So the doors have been kind of dismantled and are ready now. The tub's on, isn't it? We lifted the tub on the other day. In fact, that picture is on one of our Instagrams, isn't it?
Yeah, it's on mine. Oh, I tagged you in it, so it should be on yours as well.
Yeah, it is. So, yeah, there's just a couple of bits to do, adjustments to be made, and then we can take that off to paint as well. Yeah, sometimes I look at that project and I think there's so much to do, and then other times I think there's not that much to do, but there is a lot to do.
There is a lot, but once we get the wiring through the chassis and the tub can go on, we get the brake pipes on, it all comes together. You can concentrate on separate systems one system at a time, which is the best way to do it.
You're making it sound very simple there.
Well, breaking it down into,
subsections.
Yeah, that's the way to do it, I think, personally.
Yeah.
and before you know it, you know, there's lots of little fiddly bits like lining the body up and making sure everything's clipped in and routed properly. There's a lot of intricacies as well, but doing one system at a time really does help. In my experience, I think that's the way forward.
But we had a really nice day, didn't we, on Monday, because we recorded a podcast there.
At the shed.
During our sort of like coffee break, if you will.
Mm.
And it was just lovely, to a nice warm day.
Yeah,
it felt like we really achieved quite a lot in just a handful of hours.
Yeah, definitely. We've got a little bit of massaging to do with the tabs on the cross member, and then once the tub is in its final resting place, we can drill the holes and off it can go for it.
Yeah, that can go, but we put all the cappings on, didn't we? Because I didn't realise that Lando didn't paint underneath where the cappings go. So I'm going to leave my the body cappings galvanised, but Lando would have just masked that up then.
Yeah, so when you take the cappings off, certainly older tubs, you can normally see where the paint has like gone up just underneath them a bit, and then it fades into nothing.
Yeah.
So I don't know what process they would have used, but yeah, it's quite funny, really.
So obviously the rivets go through the rear wings, which we've had to drill.
Yeah.
But I was worried because obviously I didn't want silver prop rivets showing through.
Yes.
And no paint.
Yes.
But then I didn't want the body shop to have to put the cappings on.
Yeah. It's a bit of a catch-22, really. But it's looking really good, and your air riveter just makes riveting stuff on an absolute dream, doesn't it?
You know, it's one of those tools that I borrowed about 5 years ago. It's never gone back from Pete.
Right, okay. Long-term loan.
So poor old Pete's having to use his, like, handheld pot riveter while I have...
Swanning around.
Swanning around.
Going...
An air riveter, I think, if you've got any amount of pot riveting to do and you have a compressor, I think that is a really good tool to have.
Definitely.
It's actually so therapeutic.
I used my Lazy Tongs rivet when I did my tub, which is like a big concertina type thing, and you put the rivet in the end and then you push the handle towards it, and it does take a lot of the like arm strain out of riveting, because you're not messing around with a silly little, like, you know, like a pistol grip type one,
which we were using on the
heater box. Yeah, it takes a lot of fatigue out, but it isn't the most accurate, I think.
Because you're wobbling around.
Yeah,
the riveter, you can hold it against the air riveter, you can hold the, you know, when it lets go, and you can control it so you don't scratch your paintwork.
It's really good.
They're really good.
You can get electric ones now as well. Milwaukee do an electric pot river. I'd love one of them, but...
I bet they're a lot of money.
Everything is. It's Milwaukee, Steve. It's expensive stuff, but it's decent. If you're doing it day in, day out, it's really, really worth having. And, of course, you don't need a compressor.
In fact, when I was at Defender Ear Tubs having a tub made, that he has an array of Milwaukee tools.
But does he?
The whole lot is them, because he said we can't have unreliable stuff.
Yeah, definitely.
And when they put the, what are those other rivets called? They're like completely flat.
Countersunk
rivets.
Yeah.
And then he's got another type as well. And there's different tools. They cost hundreds and hundreds of pounds, these things.
I've got friends who are still in the motor trade full time, and they'll only buy Milwaukee stuff because they need reliability, and they need... All the batteries fit everything when you buy one brand.
Yeah, but you see, I'm like that with DeWalt.
Okay.
Because I bought a drill and an impact driver.
Yeah.
Then you get the battery system, don't you, and a charger. Then I've got a jigsaw with it.
Mm.
I won't change now.
Oh, no, that's the thing, isn't it?
I say you get become brand loyal, isn't it, I suppose?
Yeah.
It's kind of...
Yeah, it is. I mean, for DIY stuff, machinemark.co.uk, there's not much on there that you... You can't really go wrong with a lot of the gear you can get off there. It's all name brand, most of it. It's, just buy it as and when you need it. Because when, like, a rivet gun's great, like your air riveter, but realistically, it's probably sat there for months before you've... Oh, no, you used it on your trailer.
I used it on the trailer as well. I've done enough with that to justify having bought it.
Yeah, sure.
But I haven't had to buy it because I borrowed it.
Yeah.
5 years ago.
Yeah.
It's like when I lent my mate, like, a CD years ago. I still never got it back. It's like over 20 years. I haven't forgotten, though.
Yeah, nor's Pete, probably. He'll be ringing you up now.
No. It means in 5 years he's not done anything with a prop rivet.
Yeah, either that or he has actually just forgotten where it is.
Yeah. No, he knows it's here. He knows I've still got it.
You little tea leaf.
Yeah.
Anyway, on that, shall we call it a day?
Yeah, but you know when we call it a day, I've got to go and do some actual serious...
Genuine
number crunching work.
You have. You've got Excel spreadsheets to look at. It's all glamour here at Orient
Towers. Everyone thinks we're just driving around in Land Rovers enjoying ourselves. But actually, yeah, it can be quite taxing.
Don't listen to Steve. It's all good fun.
I just wanted an excuse to moan, right?
Yeah. Well, you don't normally need an excuse. Right.
Moan on the podcast is different.
Yeah. All right, then. Cool. Righto. Well, thanks again for listening. Don't forget, sign up for the LRM newsletter. Follow us on our social media channels, Land Rover Martin,
Steve Miller Automotive,
and of course, Land Rover Monthly on Instagram and Facebook and YouTube. Always new and exciting stuff happening. So keep your finger on the Land Rover pulse.
Because none of that costs you any money.
A penny.
Nor does listen to this.
Indeed. But do you know what does cost you a penny? Because you get really, really good information with integrity and excellent quality photography and written by people who know what they're talking about. Land Rover Monthly magazine.
And if you subscribe, save money.
You absolutely do. And if you don't want to subscribe, you can go and buy it in the shop because it's on sale in all good newsagents and supermarkets. So, but yeah, subscribing does save you money and you get it a few days earlier than people who buy it in the supermarket. So anyway, that's quite enough of the marketing nonsense. Thanks again for listening. See you next week.
Bye for now.